I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. I'm here to have conversations, real, honest, authentic conversations, the kind we aren't supposed to have anymore. I interview anyone I find interesting, from left to right to everywhere in between. I work independently in order to have the freedom to say what I believe and to speak to whoever I want. But with independence comes a lot of work and insecurity. I rely on donors and patrons, so individuals, to support my work so I can continue to do what I do. If you support my work and would like me to continue to do what I do, please consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Megan Murphy. Thank you so much for supporting conversations outside the algorithm. Today on the show, I'm speaking with Colin Wright, managing editor of Quillette and an evolutionary biologist who has been writing about gender identity and the reality of biology. You can find his writing on science and pseudoscience, free speech, wokeness, academia, and the gender identity debate at Reality's Last Stand on Substack. Hi, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me on. I've been looking forward to coming on for a while. I've been watching your show a lot.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I've been meaning to connect with you for a long time also, so I'm glad to finally have done so.
We had brief interactions right before you got kicked off of Twitter, because I think I started on Twitter a month or two before you got kicked off. And I remember you had been like retweeting some of my stuff, and then you were booted. And then that's just been the last 2 years, huh?
And then Twitter was no fun ever again, right?
I still see people with the, you know, Megan Murphy did nothing wrong on their Twitter handles. You're still out there. There's a diehard contingent that won't let it go.
Okay, good. I'm glad to not have been completely forgotten, erased from the internet.
Yeah.
I do miss Twitter, though, to be honest. I liked Twitter, and I feel disconnected from what's going on, and I worry about getting forgotten.
Yeah. I don't know what I would do if I got booted off there. I have to filter the stuff I say through what I think might be Twitter's ever-changing and retroactively applied rules. So yeah, there's a lot of things. Like, I won't say in a single tweet this, like, trans people aren't, you know, this one sex. I'll have to like sort of kind of circle around to it in a way where it's maybe in separate tweets where you can like piece together what I'm saying based on that, just because I have no idea what people are going to report and what's going to get me booted.
I know, it's tough. I mean, since I got kicked off, I've been operating differently too, because I'm like, so when I got kicked off, I had to start like a public Facebook page and a public Instagram page, and I started a YouTube channel, and I signed up for like alternative social media accounts, which I hadn't really been using any of that stuff, mostly just because I don't really love social media and I just didn't want more of it. I was like, I feel like I spend enough time on social media, and I also need to work, so I don't want to be on all this stuff. But because of the nature of my work, I'm dependent on it. But I'm super paranoid about getting kicked off of anything, because it'll have such a big impact. So it's, and like you say, like, we don't really even know what it is that we can say and not say. So I really don't like policing myself, but like,
I've noticed Twitter's been trying to push their, what is their newsletter. It's kind of like their response to Substack. And it's just like,
oh my God, really?
No way I'm going to write essays on what I think. I barely, like, I scour my tweets with just like, you know, fine tooth comb, like, what could possibly be taken out of context? There's no way I'm just going to write casually, extemporaneously on a topic about trans issues or anything on a whole newsletter. And then they also want to do the Twitter spaces. It's kind of their response to Clubhouse. It's like, no, because I'm going to be speaking, you know, off the cuff. And are they going to be using the same rules they do to, you know, on your tweets to, you know, if you get kicked off of their spaces, are you kicked off Twitter for good? So that's just absolutely not. And now Substack is getting weird too. The whole Jesse Single thing going on. I don't know if you saw
any what's happening with Substack. I know a bit about what's been going on with Jesse Single, but only that he's constantly being harassed and attacked and libeled by these liberal feminist types.
There was like a popular Substacker. Yeah, something Doyle. I can't remember their last name.
I think that, it's something else now. Yeah. But I knew this individual as Sadie for some time.
Yeah, so I'm not sure, but I know that they recently just did this hit piece on Jesse Singles saying that he's been like stalking trans people and making all these ridiculous claims, and then they were complaining to Substack that they should, you know, they need to police their content more and get people like Jesse Single kicked off. And then Substack responded to them instead of saying like, no, they said, well, can we appease you by giving you a pro account, which would make them have like a higher percentage of the money. And then they got to then just, you know, just tell everyone, you know, publicly reject the money offer. Like, if you have money to give me on this, then you have money to curate your content better. And so they're just putting it in a weird position where they're pressuring the Substack higher ups to censor stuff like Jesse Single. And I mean, I write stuff on that too. He's kind of takes a lot of gravity away from my stuff. Everyone focuses on him. I feel like he's sort of like Jupiter and I'm Mars. He's taken all the meteors away from slamming into me. Because he's just has a bigger gravity on this topic. So I can sort of write what I think and people don't come after me nearly as much.
Huh. I mean, it's funny with, I've sort of never understood why he's a target because, he's never really said anything controversial before. And he actually goes along with it. I like Jesse, so I'm not trying to like diss him or whatever, but I get annoyed because he uses terms like cis and TERF and sort of goes along with these narratives, or at least the language that you're supposed to use, which I oppose because I feel like that's a slippery slope, right? And obviously I oppose the word TERF because it's slanderous, but he's pretty tepid in these issues, and yet he's like attacked like crazy. So I find it a bit odd that he's targeted.
Yeah, they just want to come after him because they know he's making money from Substack and his podcast. And
right, yeah.
So
well, and I think it bugs him. Like, what they come after him, and he gets really, really upset. So I think bullies like that. I mean, I sort of learned that, you know, like I've been targeted and harassed and threatened for many years now, and I just kind of stopped caring. And eventually they kind of just like, if you're not really affected and you don't get all up in arms and respond and try to defend yourself, they kind of get a bit bored of you, I think, or they realize that they can't like get to you and try to find somebody else to cancel and harass.
Yeah. The people who get destroyed the most are exactly those people who will, you know, do their knee-jerk reaction is to give an immediate apology and, you know, or just admit they did something wrong. And then once they do that, they think it's going to be like, oh, it's okay. But like, no, they just see that as just a place to put a wedge in there. And now they're going to get you. Now that you are guilty, you admitted you did something wrong. Now we're going to just put on the gas. So they have really short attention times though. So I find if you just ignore them like crazy, usually within a day, it goes away. Like they'll stop pestering you.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, but, you know, as we both know, cancel culture doesn't really exist. AOC said so.
Yeah. You know, what I'm seeing now is getting so annoying is that a lot of, like, Republicans are taking the whole cancel culture narrative and they're applying it to, like, these really light cases now where they're just like, you know, they actually just get called a name and they're just like, cancel culture, I'm getting canceled. It's like, oh, my God. Like, you can't just, like, now you're just making it ridiculous.
Right.
And all the people who are actually have a legitimate, you know, gripe about what's going on and the constant harassment and people contacting their employers and for not even saying bad things. Like, I'm just saying, like, the worst thing I've ever said is males and females are different and that matters in certain contexts. And, you know, for that, people were contacting university that I was applying to and just trying to make these Twitter armies come after me and tweeting at Penn State and everything like that, just trying to get some higher up to reprimand me. Like, that's more of the whole cancel culture thing for saying stuff that everyone agreed was true just like a week ago. It's now, you can't say it.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about your experience with cancel culture. Can you tell me a bit more about what happened to you?
Yeah, it's not as a dramatic story. Like people, it's hard for me to say if I was canceled. I think I experienced cancel culture, but I wouldn't say I was particularly canceled. But it's hard to say if you are or not, because you never know how many job offers and interviews you're not getting based on your views. So it's one of those, you know, maybe my CV was just horrible in academia and nobody wanted to give me interviews. But then I would see a bunch of colleagues that I had who are in my same position, and I have 3 times, 4 times as many publications as them and better journals, and they're getting all kinds of interviews from everyone, you know, just phone interviews, and they're getting flown around the country. And like, why am I not getting any even phone interviews? I'm applying to 150 universities. So there's that aspect. I don't know how many interviews I wasn't getting. I suspected, and people told me too, that it probably mattered quite a bit. I guess I should back up a little bit of why I was worrying about that stuff. So I think it was in 2018 is when I had sort of had enough of all the sex denialism I was seeing on social media and the news and things like that. I had people on my Facebook, close friends, people who were PhD students in anthropology departments and stuff. They were sharing links to articles saying like, oh, there's 5 sexes and, you know, using, you know, all these different chromosomal types. These are all different sexes. There's 6 sexes. Or they'd share the Scientific American piece that says, you know, there's not even just 5 sexes. It's just, sex is just a complete spectrum. There's just an infinite variety of sexes. And that it was just insane. And so at first I thought it was maybe just this little group of my friends on Facebook. And then I'm seeing it crop up all over the place. And it was hard for me not to focus on that because I had been really involved in sort of the new atheist movement in the late 2000s, early 2010s. So I'd always argue against like the young earth creationists and intelligent design people. And I was always sort of defending biology with what I saw was these attacks from outside the academy, trying to discredit the science. And there was a sort of a difference because when I would push back against these ideas that there's 5 sexes or that there's, you know, sex is a spectrum, people weren't even like saying that I was wrong particularly. Like they would say that, but then it was always followed up with like, you're a horrible, horrible bigot, transphobe. And it would just turn into this big pile on. And I'm just like, oh my God, I thought these people were my friends. Like they really don't know that I'm a good person just making a factual argument. And so this culminated with me sort of writing down all my frustrations in an article I published in Quillette in 2018 called The New Evolution Deniers. It was basically talking about the sex denialism and people denying sexual dimorphism. And that went really sort of viral on Twitter and got a bunch of views. And so that was what kind of made people aware that I'm someone who exists in this sphere. And then I was still applying for jobs at that time because I had gotten a new postdoc position at Penn State and I was applying for professor jobs, all these tenure track places. And so I would lock my Twitter down because I didn't want people to be Googling my name and see the stuff I'm tweeting about. And then I ended up breaking sort of that silence with an article I wrote with Dr. Emma Hilton. And we published an article called The Dangerous Denial of Sex. And it was in the Wall Street Journal, which just like really blew up. And so then people started contacting Penn State saying that they, you know, they felt unsafe. Me saying that there's only 2 sexes said people, well, students were saying that it was attacking their non-binary identities, even though I'm not talking about their identity, I'm talking about male and female. Professors were tweeting about, you know, me because, you know, Jerry Coyne had liked my piece and they couldn't believe that there was this transphobe at the university. So Penn State was actually very good about the whole thing. They didn't sanction me and I was actually even offered to extend my contract. But there was sort of a campaign on Twitter to contact the jobs that I was applying to. People posted on, there's this website called Eco Evo Jobs. It's like a big Google document. And if you're an ecologist or an evolutionary biologist, which is what I do, everyone goes to that website to look for jobs because everybody posts, you find a job anywhere, it posts on this feed. And someone decided they were just going to make a job. And the job was just titled, Colin Wright is a white supremacist and a transphobe or something like that. And it was just up there. And I just got a bunch of emails from people saying like, oh my God, I saw your name on there. And of course, people who don't know me are just going to assume that this is all true. And I contacted the board operator and there's nothing they can do about it. Maybe they removed it, but you know, they don't curate stuff before they're posted. And I was just like, this is just getting insane. And I wasn't getting any interviews for whatever reason. And I just felt like no matter how hard I might work on this job, trying to get a professor job, I wasn't confident that my hard work was actually going to translate into getting a job. And if I did get a job, you know, it's just going to be hurdle after hurdle of trying to get tenure. And, you know, I'm going to have students, obviously they're going to say that they feel unsafe and that's not going to look good on a tenure review package. And so I decided to leave academia on my own. And luckily Claire at Quillette saw that I was leaving and someone had just left there. And so they offered me a job. And so that's what I'm doing now. I'm an editor for Quillette. And I thought I was going to be a online fitness and nutrition coach. That was what my plan B was at the moment. So, and now I'm able to talk about this stuff all the time. So I'm free. I'm pretty much uncancelable, I think, unless I say something extremely egregious that would even make Quillette flinch. And at that point, I'd probably deserve it if I can do that. So
yeah,
you'll be okay. So that's kind of my trajectory, I suppose.
So you're no longer in academia at all?
Nope. Well, I'm kind of in a good position now because even though I'm not in academia, I've been getting contacted by some nice journals who are wanting me to write these articles about, you know, basically pushing back against these things you see in Nature and the New England Journal of Medicine saying that sex isn't binary and things like that. So I'm currently writing a few papers right now on invitation from some good journals because they can't find anyone who's currently in academia to write these things. And so they have to like find this exiled like spider biologist such as myself to just make the argument. And because I can't, they can't do anything about it. Like they can't hold tenure over my head. And right. So it's actually a good position. It's the best of both worlds. I can still write these scientific articles and for real science journals without worrying about its impact on my career. So it's really the best outcome I could have ever hoped for with the whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what a blessing it is in many ways to not be attached to either an academia or even attached to any kind of institution because it makes you so vulnerable. Like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe I just would have said it anyway. I probably would have said it anyway and gotten fired or canceled or whatever I was going to say. Like, because I was on track to do a PhD and I decided not to, like after I'd finished my master's degree and went into journalism instead and was writing and doing all that. And, you know, I wasn't interested in pursuing it because I was like, I don't want to teach. I don't want to do research. I'm tired of writing these stupid academic articles and nobody reads. But yeah. I mean, thank God, like, where would I have gotten? I was in gender studies too, right? Oh, boy. But like, tell me about, I know, can you imagine? Tell me about what's been happening. So I, you know, with reference to that article you just mentioned around evolutionary biology, you wrote about how like the left essentially began rejecting evolutionary biology. So how did you see that happening? What was going on?
Yeah, I kind of saw a shift because back when I was sort of arguing against the creationists and intelligent design people, there was no pressure on me to censor myself about, you know, dunking on religion and sort of these ideas that, you know, we were all created 6,000 years ago in our present form, Adam and Eve, like, the scientists, evolutionary biology, they're perfectly fine colleagues who are, you know, just completely dunking on those ideas in very strident terms if you want to do it. And, you know, people like Richard Dawkins, that's what he basically did. And that's what I did for a long time. And I would just get nothing but praise from people within the academy saying, you know, good job for arguing against these bad ideas. And then I saw sort of a shift to what was attacking biology and evolutionary biology and just basic notions of how we understand male and female and even evolution, because there's this sort of blank slate belief where males and females don't have any evolved differences. It used to be that blank slateism just was applied to sort of our minds, and that your brains are the result of socialization that explains like all of our differences in behavior between men and women. But now we sort of have a blank slate sort of morphology where people are even starting to deny that males are even stronger than females on average, and that whole thing. But the dynamic shifted because the people who were arguing for creationism, intelligent design, they were outside of the university. They're the religious right, and they don't really have any power in academia. So there's just really nothing they can do that could get somebody like me fired for speaking out against intelligent design. But that wasn't the case with this new sort of sex evolution denialism that was coming from the left, because the left very much does run the universities to a large degree, just as a proportion of professors. And so I felt myself having to self-censor more on things that I just, I was going to say thought to be true, but I just, the most boilerplate introductory biological claims I can possibly make, like male and female are real, there's only two sexes. You know, I just can't imagine a more uncontroversial thing to say as a biologist. But I was being told to censor, and you know, even my advisors who were on my side said, like, "Oh, you're absolutely completely right on all these things, but you can't say that because it'll just ruin your career." And I was like, "This is insane! Like, why did I get into science in the first place? Like, I had wanted to become a professor because I thought this is the academy was someplace where I could, you know, push the frontier of knowledge and have good academic debates, and people would understand that, you know, they would understand how to have a debate, and evidence and reason is all that matters, and not just to assume I'm a horrible person." And that just wasn't the case anymore. So that's another reason, I guess, I left academia, because it wasn't what I expected it to be, or it completely morphed as I was along my path to actually getting a professor job. So that was what my article was about, is just the change in like sort of the power dynamic from the right to the left, and how now all the crazies were sort of inside the building. And so people who are pushing back against this stuff, you know, we're no longer protected by the walls of the institution.
I wonder if you feel like, you know, feminism is partly responsible for this blank slateism approach and this rejection of evolutionary biology, or this, you know, this treatment of evolutionary biology is somehow regressive and sexist, or, you know, bigoted in other ways.
It definitely contributed. I had been arguing against sort of the blank slate feminist ideas well before I came out with the, you know, the before the whole sex denialism stuff took place. Even the person I was dating at the time was very much blank slateist, even though I'm my PhD I was in graduate school for at the time, I was a behavioral ecologist, and so it was a very there's that thing we couldn't talk about, was like, well, this is like what I do. So I'm sorry. I think to the degree to which feminism latched on to sort of that queer theory where they try to just to like blur the lines between everything, and not even just blurring the lines, but obliterate all boundaries whatsoever, and have a hyper focus on socialization. Yeah, there's some blame there for sure. I think in the last few years, though, I've seen sort of a shift, though, and there's a lot more feminists that are sort of willing to say, okay, maybe there are some biological differences. And I think some of them have maybe been forced to admit that just because they're seeing how this left contingent of people are just denying, like they see the consequences of denying innate differences is doing in certain realms. And they're saying, oh, maybe there's something here, and maybe we've gone too far. So I've been really happy to see sort of that shift and that alliance now. Kathleen Stock had written some really great articles, some for Colette actually, on this, that I thought were really great, and saying, you know, it was no longer rejecting the notion that brains are, you know, just purely the result of socialization. Maybe there's some actually innate personality differences, you know, on average overlap, all that stuff with all the right caveats. So I'm optimistic that there's a good alliance that's formed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had to. Thank you. I was going to say I'm guilty of that too. You know, I sort of just I took the approach that, you know, gender, and of course, what I mean by gender is gender roles. I'm not confusing sex and gender as so many do nowadays. That, you know, essentially that behaviors, preferences, any kind of patterns that exist in society that would separate men and women, I took the approach that that was, you know, almost all socialization, just because that's what I learned, honestly, and I wasn't really exposed to challenges or alternative perspectives except in the way that, you know, feminism would dismiss evolutionary biologists as a bunch of sexist men.
I think there is some justified skepticism, I think,
definitely,
that's there too, of, because I mean, you don't want to get to the point where there is some disparity that could be the result of some sort of socialization thing, and then just, you know, if your knee-jerk thing is like, oh, it's never going away, that's just human nature, like, that's not always a satisfactory answer, and that can be used to sort of shut people up and just make the status quo persist. And so we do need to be on alert that we can't just default to one or the other, because the real answer is going to be somewhere in the middle. Like, we're social creatures. We adapt to our environment. Socialization probably matters, absolutely does in a lot of cases. But then there's, you know, there's these two layers. There's the innate, and then there's the environmental component. So people always just try to go to the whole nature or nurture type thing. And there's just, it's impossible to just separate them out and say, like, what percentage is nature? What percent? Well, it's just, they're combined in ways that it's not even just like a percentage of each. It's a process of evolution that, you know, we've evolved to have socialization be a thing and be adaptive in certain situations. And then there's also certain innate things. And so it's just this, you know, and being socialized for things changes like the adaptive landscape too, for other things to evolve. So it's just it's a give and take. There's not, yeah, it's just one big mixture of environment and genetics, I suppose.
Right. Like, you can't really say that it's all one thing or all the other. And that goes in both directions. You know, there's plenty of people who will say, oh, well, that's evolution. Like, this is what's natural, so this is what should be. And, you know, just because something is natural doesn't mean necessarily that that's the way it should be, that that's the way it has to be, that we can't, you know, change things. And I think there should be a lot more flexibility on both ends of that debate.
Yeah, totally agree.
So, but in any case, I mean, when in talking about the gender identity aspect of all of that, the strangest thing, of course, is not just, you know, denial that there might be some sort of inherent or natural differences in terms of gender roles and behaviors, but this notion that sex no longer exists is crazy. Is that sort of how you first got involved in the gender identity debate? Just, you know, being presented with this claim that there's no such thing as sex?
Yeah. I mean, I was very much on board with the argument that, I mean, this was like pre-2014 and stuff, I guess, is when things kind of got nuts, I think. But I was totally on board with the notion that I heard a lot of sort of these activists say, which was that, you know, sex is, you know, biological, and then gender identity is this other sort of the software on top of that. And they made this, you know, hardware software distinction, and they use the different words. They would use male and female to refer to biological sex, and man and woman to refer to gender identity, or something along those lines. And I was fine with, at first I was like, oh, okay, I suppose we'll have to change a little bit the way I think about things, but, you know, why do we need both of these to refer to the same thing? Like, male and man, those are two different words. Okay, we can, as long as there was that divide between sex and identity, I was willing to make these concessions. It was when I saw that line and that wall starting to just be being taken down, and they're starting taking sledgehammers to it, is when that's when I decided to stand up and be like, this is not cool. Like, this is just pure biology denial at this point. Like, you can't just identify into a sex. And then the arguments about, you know, but intersex people exist, therefore males and females aren't real. Like, it's just the most ridiculous arguments you ever see. So, that was my impetus for first coming into this debate, because I just saw, what I thought was the divide I was willing to compromise on was no longer what they were after. And I always suspected it too. It's always in the back of my head. It's like, okay, I always got the sort of the impression that people were maybe trying to blur these lines a little bit, but I was, I guess, super naive looking back on it, because it wasn't long until most people adopted the whole, like, oh yeah, sex and gender, these are different things. Like, that only lasted for like a very brief time before they started picking away at the wall between those two concepts. And now you see people use sex/gender, or, you know, they won't say male and female. Like, I'm reading a book right now, The Spectrum of Sex. They don't even say male and female. They just refer to like traits associated with male and female. It's like, how do you know what traits are associated with being a male or a female? If you don't know what a male and female is apart from those traits, it's the most ridiculous book. And these are like what people recommend.
It's so funny, because when you try to get to the root of it, things get very blurry and circular. I mean, people just don't respond. But if you say, you know, I'm always like, why is it, okay, if there's no such thing as a male or female, nobody knows what a male or female is, it can just be anything, you can't even tell, then why is there this, like, insistence, almost like, you know, a violent insistence, you know, a really extreme insistence that, you know, a trans man is literally a man, and that a trans woman is literally a woman. And it's like, well, if those words don't even mean anything, then what are you even saying? Like, what are you, if you're saying a trans woman is a woman, then what is a woman, and why does it matter to you that you be accepted or treated or identified as one of these things that doesn't even really exist?
Yeah. I mean, that's the one question that they'll never answer, is define woman in a way that doesn't use the word woman in the sentence already. Like, they won't, it's completely always a self-referential, and it always goes back. It's always sort of relies on, I think the definition I see people use the most is like, a woman is anyone who like lives and identifies as a woman. It's like, well, what does it mean to live as one? They're like, you know. And then you look at them, and they're wearing like, it's some male wearing high heels and a dress. It's like, is that what it means to live in? I know a lot of women who wear jeans and stuff. So are they not living as a woman? And they'll constantly reject the idea that what they're doing is reducing man and woman down to these sex-based stereotypes. But there's just no avoiding that. That's exactly what they're doing in every single situation. And it's highlighted too in the whole non-binary identity. It's like, well, how can you identify out of a sex category completely? Like, it's not even that they're intersex. It's just that they just don't identify. Like, well, what do you mean you're not identifying with those? And always it's, well, they don't identify with the norms and expectations that are placed on, you know, males and females based on their perceived sex. Like, that's what they're doing. And my take is that, like, okay, so let's stop applying these expectations based on perceived sex, rather than saying, agreeing with that those norms and expectations are what define man and woman. Like, just defy those boundaries if you want to. It doesn't mean you're not a man or a woman.
Of course. I mean, and that's been insane. One of the most frustrating things for me, and obviously many other feminists, because it's like, well, that was kind of the whole point, or not the whole point, but that was like a key aim in feminism, was to say, like, you don't have to identify with these stereotypes. Like, just because you're a woman, that doesn't mean that you have to love makeup and high heels or objectification, or that you're passive, or that you're irrational or over emotional and blah, 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 blah. And now these people come along and say, well, I don't identify, you know, like I don't like wearing high heels. I don't like having long hair. I don't like wearing makeup. Like I feel like more aggressive, or I like to play with the boys more, or whatever it is. I'm interested in sports or cars. So therefore I'm not really a woman. I'm actually non-binary. And it's like, you just missed. And these are the people who now I think sort of present themselves as the most modern of feminists, as it were. You know, they're the ones pushing forward, you know, rejecting all these sexist stereotypes and pushing us towards a more modern world.
I saw a tweet recently that I thought encapsulated like the gender ideology so well. I'm probably going to butcher it, but it was something like, you know, the second wave feminists talked about, you know, a man and a woman, they can both be in the kitchen. And then it's like, the new ideology is like the person in the kitchen by definition is the woman, you know, it's like, that's how they're defining it. They're defining womanhood by the role that you take now instead of sort of, you know, having that divorce from it. And this is also, so this reliance on these stereotypes of masculinity and femininity, this is why I also sort of reject when people refer to me as being cis, because I don't identify like as a man. That's not, I don't even know what that means really. And I reject using that word cis to describe myself because, one, like, I don't know what it means to identify as man aside from identifying with, you know, these sex-based stereotypes of masculinity. And I don't identify with these, you know, with Randy Macho Man Savage masculinity. So I'm somewhere less masculine than him. Does that mean I'm more towards the non-binary, like a non-binary? Like what am I agreeing here? Like using the word cis to me is just sort of just using their own idea. I'm within their framework of talking about sex and gender and the use of stereotypes to define what it is to be a man and a woman. And that's why I don't even like to use the word cis because it's I'm already giving them that argument. Like I'm working from within their system, and it's that system that I just completely reject all the way down.
Right. And I've always rejected using the term cis for the same reason, you know, like I don't identify as anything. I'm female. I'm an adult female. So that's what makes me a woman. Like, I don't know what it feels like to feel like a woman. I know what it feels like to be me. And it's just sort of a redundant word. And you're right. It just sort of, it normalizes and accepts this ideology that there's such a thing as a cis woman and a trans woman. And it's, you know, it's all women. It's just different kinds of women. And it's like, none of these words mean anything. Like, this isn't, what is it? I don't identify with femininity. And that's, to me, what the word cis means. It means you, mm-hmm. well, not to me. I mean, that's how it's defined. Like, it's you're a male and you identify with what it means to be a man. So masculinity. And, you know, you're a female and you identify with what it means to be a woman. So femininity. And it's like, I don't, there's some aspects of femininity that I suppose I don't know, participate in. And there's some aspects like that I feel, you know, I feel masculine in some ways. But I mean, at the end of the day, I don't even, these words to me are sort of pointless. Like, gender itself to me is a bit pointless. I'm like, I don't really, this isn't important. Like, people have personalities. Like, people have likes, people have dislikes, people have behaviors. Like, I don't even really think we need gender as like a concept.
This describes everybody. I mean, if you read Rebecca Riley Cooper's article, what is like something about gender ideology is making a new gender prison or something. And it had a quote in there that was, you know, talking about how we're all non-binary because no one is this perfect, you know, platonic stereotype of masculinity or femininity. And that's just kind of what we're being asked to define man and woman by. When did this take place? When did that shift happen? You were in the whole gender. I mean, you were getting your PhD in it, weren't you? Like, what was
Masters,
where was that shift? Because I thought the original goal was to say that these are oppressive labels to apply to females, and now it seems like they are oppressive. Like, now we're just not female or a woman anymore.
They've basically just
turned over and agreed that, yeah, a woman means you're submissive and feminine. Like,
when I was doing my master's degree in gender, sexuality, and women's studies, there wasn't a concept, like gender identity wasn't a thing that existed. Like, we didn't use that term. We did, like, when I was in doing my graduate degree, we had to read, like, trans theory. It was called, you know, I think I had like some kind of trans theory book. And I remember there being discussions about trans people and transgenderism, but it was never that. And this was, you know, like I did all my degrees quite late in life, and it took me a really long time to finish because I went part-time for so long because I was working. But so I finished my master's degree, I think, in like 2011 or 2012. So it wasn't, you know, that long ago, but all these ideas, like where it was pushed to the point where there's no such thing as sex and a trans woman is literally female, that all came after. That was all new. So, but, you know, probably fairly recently after that, you know, like the reason that I sort of first got involved in this debate was really to defend the women who were under attack and, you know, women's spaces that were under attack. You know, I'm from Vancouver, so Vancouver Rape Relief has long been a target of trans activists, mm-hmm. because it's a woman-only space and because they only have female volunteers and train females to counsel, you know, victims of abuse and rape who come through the center or call. And, you know, they were forced through this whole human rights tribunal process because trans women wanted to train as a counselor and they said, sorry, no, only females, and explained why. So they've been attacked as transphobic for a really, really long time. But yeah, the idea that there was no such thing as sex and that the total blurring of those lines, like, you know, now gender identity, you know, to identify as transgender, it has nothing to do with transitioning. You don't have to have surgery. You don't have to be on hormones. You don't have to, not that I think that this should be the line where you accept somebody as the opposite sex, but, you know, there was at least some kind of expectation that you were, I suppose, wanting to appear on a superficial level as the opposite sex. And now it's just, you know, it mm-hmm. could be any, you know, you could just tell me right now, you know, like I'm a lady, and I would have to be like, yes, you are, you know, like, so I don't know. I mean, I was actually going to ask you what you think the motivation was. I don't know if you have an answer, but for that blurring of lines, for that claim that, you know, sex is too complicated for us to possibly understand. It's too nuanced for us to even be able to define who's a male and female. I mean, there's so just, you know, there's all sorts of things going on. Who could possibly tell?
It really comes across to me as just a power grab. Like, I don't know. I mean, but it's sort of, they have this layer of care over it. And there are people I know who do think that they're just being super caring about it. But it's reaching the point where, you know, at some point, you know, it's one thing to socially accommodate people who have dysphoria in a social context. And I don't know your stance on this, but I'm pretty much more than willing to use people's preferred pronouns in the social setting. Like if I'm out to dinner with people and have friends, and even if they're not in the room, I'll happily talk about, you know, if it's a trans woman, I'll refer to them as she, and vice versa. But at some point, and this is what I've just been trying to do with my articles, is saying, like, you know, this should be something, you know, there's social accommodation, and then there's just like a society sort of just, I guess, bending over backwards not to offend people by taking on the, I hate to use the word delusion, but it's like it's a belief that is not true, that we're asked to believe that, you know, someone who identifies as a certain sex is that sex simply because they identify. Like, that's a delusion. And I just think I didn't see any adults in the room that were willing to just say, like, okay, at dinner in a social thing situation is one thing. But if we're going to start making laws, if we're going to start saying, therefore, you can self-identify into women's sports or into a women's rape shelter or into a women's prison, like, that's a whole other can of worms. And I just think this drive to not offend people is just leading us to this insane place.
Right.
And I think some are being pulled along because they don't quite see how crazy the end of the tip of the spear is on this thing. And then I think the people who are on the tip of the spear, I think they're just sort of either actually insane and they want power above all else. And yeah, I think that might describe the situation. Hope I didn't just get canceled, but yeah.
Yeah, me
I don't
too.
Know. I hope, I don't know a better way to say it. It's just that's I want to be the adult in the room and talk about what the issue is, but
it's hard to discuss these things frankly nowadays, but I think you're right that a lot of people, it became a thing about being nice, which then turned into this thing around hate and bigotry and whatever, but a lot of people who do go along with it, I think, surely know that sex is a real thing, but think, oh, well, why not just be nice, or it's really traumatic or hurtful to individuals to say, sorry, like, sex is real. You can't change your sex. Like, if you desire that a lot, and I'm sorry that this is tormenting you, but you can't literally do that. And, you know, like I said before, like, I got into this debate to sort of protect women who are under attack and protect other feminist activists who are under attack over in the UK and things like that, who are being libeled and canceled, you know, Julie Bendel, whatnot, Jermaine Greer. But then, you know, and then the legislation came along, and that's when I really was like, okay, I have to speak out about this. This is going to become law. This is dangerous. But there's also, it's not just about women's rights. It's about telling the truth. Like, it's like the ability and the freedom to just speak the truth and say what is true. And that's being suppressed and, you know, criminalized even in some ways. I know that you wrote something in an essay that I read. You said, you said you don't want to be wrong about any issue for a moment longer than absolutely necessary. But I think it was in that same essay that you talk about the truth. I mean, why is what's true important? I guess, I mean, it sort of seems like a stupid question, but it's not stupid because so many people don't think it's important. Like, it's no longer important to be able to speak the truth. It's more important to say what's politically correct or what's nice or what isn't going to get you fired or canceled or, like, what's not going to piss off your friends. I'm like, no, the truth, it's really important. Telling the truth matters. But, like, why?
Yeah, I mean, well, if we want to accurately diagnose any problem, and if you care about the well-being of people and the oppression that people go through and experience, if you care about morality, what's right and what's wrong, I don't see how you can actually do what's right and avoid doing what's wrong if you're not actually committed to the state of reality, to some sort of epistemology that checks your beliefs against some objective standard. And that's I think what we're sort of losing. If you don't have, if it's not true that males and females are different, then there's a lot of consequences that stem from that. If it is true, then there's a whole different set of consequences that stem from that. And so I see sex differences, biological sex itself, the difference between males and females. I mean, this is a fundamental property of our species, not just humans, but almost every species there is. All mammals, you know, go back to reptiles, amphibians. I mean, this sex is, it's so prevalent. We've had it in our lineage for probably over 500 million years, you don't just get to deny a fundamental aspect of a species or of humanity and expect not to have that denial sort of emerge in other areas that lead to just sort of these glitches in the matrix popping up all over the place of just like, oh. And I see the, you know, the fact that we have males competing at female sports, like, to me, that's just like, oh, that's a really good test case of maybe our premises were incorrect moving forward on this. And having a male in a female prison, this is like, oh, okay, this is something that's clearly gone wrong. It's easier to see when reality, your belief in reality don't match in a field like engineering, because you get to actively see a bridge that you thought was going to be really, you know, super well designed on paper, just completely crumble in front of you. And when we're talking about sociology type things and other aspects of human nature and things that are less, you know, I guess grounded in physics and are more just sort of things we people debate upon, you don't quite see those bridges collapsing. But I do see, I see those in this context. I see males and female sports is the equivalent of like a bridge collapsing, that this, so there's something not right here. There's our ideas about how the world works is clearly flawed. If this is what we're, if this is the conclusion of that belief system. So I can't remember exactly what your question was, but that's where I ended. So,
well, I asked why telling the truth matters.
Yeah,
there's lots of reasons why it matters in terms of science and biology. But I mean, also sort of on a more like philosophical level, I guess, you know, why does it matter that we be able to tell the truth, like we'd be free to tell the truth, but also that we value telling the truth? Because I feel disturbed that it's sort of is so unimportant to so many people that they tell the truth, that they've decided that it's more important to repeat the mantras, not question the mantras, not wonder if those mantras are meaningful or helpful or accurate, but that, like, I just feel like I would die if I couldn't tell the truth. Like, I couldn't live like that. I'm not capable of it. I know that I'm not, but a lot of people are.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I wanted to be a scientist in the first place, is because I cared about what's true. Hearing people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, you know, and I could put on my Sam Harris hat and address, you know, why is truth important? And he would say something along the lines of, you know, beliefs fuel your actions. However you believe is going to dictate how you're going to act. Actions are things that affect those around you. That's how you interact with the world around you and affect other people. If you're affecting other people, then you want to make sure that your beliefs actually reflect reality, because then your actions could, once they're affecting people, if it's not based in reality, then you're going to be affecting them in a way that's not actually justified. And if it is grounded in reality, you know, they still might not like it, but at least it's a justified way to go about treating individuals in certain situations. So yeah, I mean, that's the basic, I guess, logic behind it, is we want our actions to be in line with the truth, because those are what is interacting with the world and how people are affected by our actions. So beliefs, they don't just sit in your brain. You might think they do, but they interact with the world around you and through your actions, and, you know, could be the way you vote and or the way you treat people on a day-to-day basis. But I don't want to treat people in a way that's not justified in some way. And so because I wouldn't want to have someone just irrationally treating me a certain way and have no ability to argue against them. So mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my... Because that's why I think the truth matters. And I think it's just more interesting than just making stuff up.
Pretty much. It is more interesting. I mean, authenticity is more admirable and more interesting and more compelling, I think, than phoniness. So I think that's a version of explaining also why telling the truth is important.
And it's easier to be consistent, too, if your standard is like what you think is true based on evidence and reason. You don't have to constantly be making new arguments because your arguments are getting blown out of the water. I mean, someone recently brought to my attention this argument that was sitting right up there that I never pieced together before. But you get these people that are saying that there's that each like chromosomal variation besides XX and XY is its own unique sex. And from that premise, people are saying that there's, you know, there's more than two sexes, there's maybe six sexes, because there's like six or seven or certain ways that people can have different chromosomal arrangements, sex chromosomes. And it's like, okay, well, if you're saying that being something other than XX means you're less male or female, then how does that go for the argument that, you know, trans women are biologically female because it's trans women are XY? So you're saying that they're, because they have this other chromosomal thing, they're something other than female now? Like, that's just two completely contradictory arguments that you see out there. But they don't care about them because they have the conclusion. They know where they need to get to. They need to get to this idea that there's more than two sexes, or that there's an infinite number of sexes. Any number besides two, that's basically what they, where they have to get to. And so any argument that gets there, even if it's starting from this place of complete insanity, to them is just justified. It's, they know where they need to be, and they don't care about, you know, how they get there whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that's what we're up against. I don't know how to argue against it. I don't like to argue with those people. Well, I'll argue with them, not because I think I'm going to change this person's mind, because you can just tell if that's what they're doing, they don't care about what you're about to say. They're just waiting for the next opportunity to speak. But there's a lot of people that are watching. Like, if I'll look at some of my tweet interactions with people who are just saying the most insane things, and you can see the tweet impressions, and might only have a few likes on them, but you get like 1,000 tweet impressions. Like, there's people that are seeing this conversation going on. And I get emails from people or DMs from people saying like, yeah, that person's insane. And like, I'm glad that you kept a level head and you just linked to your Substack article that made the argument in a, you know, non-aggressive way. So I'm still trying to hope to change the undecided middle, if they exist. I think they do, but some people are convinced that maybe that's not the case.
Yeah. I mean, always those kinds of debates on Twitter are about the audience, not the person you're arguing with, because it's people very rarely change their minds in Twitter arguments. But it's about who's watching. And it's also, like, to me, it's so much about just normalizing saying these things, being like, no, this isn't off the table to say that sex is real and sex matters and that males are male and females are female. Like, this is a normal, perfectly harmless, like, neutral thing to say. It's not an opinion. It's just a neutral fact. Get people, that's it.
I get people that tweet angrily at me sometimes. My own followers, because they're just like, Jesus, Colin, you're hitting a dead horse. Every day you make some tweet that's just like showing this, saying that males and females are real. There's sex differences. There's males are on average bigger, faster, and stronger. And like, yeah, it's not particularly fun for me either. Like, I know I'm just sounding like a broken record, but frankly, no one else is saying this stuff. Like, if they're going to be the ones that are making those tweets, this chanting, you know, this, the chant, you know, one after another, like, someone has to be throwing it back in their direction to getting, you know, getting retweets or something to combat this insanity that they're putting out there. It's the, when no one else is arguing against it, that's just when they've just taken over the entire conversation. So yeah, I think the normalizing, I want to just make it normal to be able to push back against these ideas. So yeah, I mean, I'll be that person that just for the last 2 years of just nonstop, almost every day, tweeting the same damn thing, writing the same article, just slightly different ways. It's like my essays are just, I feel like it's like a Taco Bell menu. It's all this very similar points, same points, just sort of put in different order and packaged slightly differently. But it's like, here's another essay about why sex is real and it matters and why gender ideology is sort of bad.
So, yeah, I can relate to that broken record.
It's easy to write it, though. I mean, I can pump them out at this point, just because it's just autopilot at this point.
Yeah. So, and I saw that the ACLU, I mean, the ACLU is such a massive disappointment nowadays. It's like beyond depressing, but the ACLU, of course, is fully on board with gender identity ideology. So they recently posted this like tweet thread debunking myths about trans people in school sports, which you responded to. So, I mean, the thread is so maddening and just like disingenuous to me, but I wanted to just go through it. So they're fact one, and just the fact that they're presenting it as facts. Yeah. This is a myth. This is a fact. Like,
I'll point out real quick before you get into it is that like you can actually replace trans or something with just all the language you could replace with you know an age statement of you know instead of a male competing in females you can just say an adult competing in a children's peewee league. I mean this all their arguments they have in this should equally apply to a situation where an adult man is trying to play you know against 8-year-olds. I mean it's
right
same exact you can make the same exact argument.
Right. So that's a good point. Yeah. So the first thing that they say fact one, trans girls are girls. And then underneath in their little explanation, it says myth, sex is binary, apparent at birth and identifiable through singular biological characteristics. I mean, how would you respond to that statement?
One, like, what do they mean by girl? Like, define what you're talking about, because they'll just equivocate between, you know, adolescent female and girl all the time. Then they'll focus on sex isn't binary. It's like, okay, well, what do you mean when you say binary? Because there's, like, a mathematical definition, which is, like, you know, or the computational thing about binary code, which is, like, just ones and zeros. But then there's sort of a more colloquial use of the word binary. And that's the one I use, which is, you know, there are only two of something. You can like a binary star system. There's only two stars in that system or a binary compound. You know, like you can, I think, what is it? Steel or something is like iron and nickel. Like that's a binary compound. It means that there's only consisting of two different things. And so I usually just try to sidestep the whole sex is binary thing. That seems to be a stumbling block. I'm willing to just be like, I'm not going to use the word binary anymore just because people will try to use like the computational definition or something. And I'll just say, there's only two sexes. There's not three. There's not five. There's not seven. There's not an infinite amount of them. Like that's all I want people to understand is when I say sex is binary. I'm just meaning there are only two sexes. It could be the case that some individuals might have conditions where they have ambiguous genitalia, their gonads have bits of ovarian tissue and testicular tissue, and you bring in a committee of doctors to like, you know, well, what are we going to classify? Maybe some individuals are really ambiguously sexed. Maybe they don't have a sex you can really discern. Possibly. I'm willing to admit that that could be the case. I don't think that necessarily everyone must be classified as male or female. Maybe some individuals might not be classified. Maybe they're ambiguous. That doesn't mean that there's more than two sexes. It just means that we have male and female. And, you know, an edge case, it's like I usually use like a coin flipping analogy sometimes where, you know, heads and tails are these real outcomes. They're, for the most part, don't come in degrees. You know, they're not like if you flip a coin, get heads. It's not like 80% heads. It's either heads or it's tails. But they've done studies with, you know, people have been flipping nickels and about 1 out of 6,000 times a nickel will land on its edge. And it's just like, oh, okay, that's neither heads or tails. And then they're using that to be like, oh, that means heads or tails doesn't exist. It's like, well, no, that's you can't quite make that leap. And strangely enough, like, so the chance that a coin will land on its edge is 1 in 6,000. That's so close to the amount of the prevalence of intersex conditions where there's truly an ambiguous outcome. It's like 1 in 5,500, I think is the number for someone who's born and at birth and they're just like either sexually ambiguous looking or there's like a mismatch between their internal reproductive organs and their like outward phenotype. So yeah, we're talking about literally a nickel landing on its edge here and using that to say that there's not two sexes or something. So
right. And okay, yeah. So fact two, it's inarguable. It's
I'll take their word for it.
Trans athletes. I hate this like internet meme where people post these like fact myth things. Like it's just always so oversimplified, and usually it's not a fact or a myth. It's just your assessment or your opinion or your analysis. But anyway,
propaganda.
Yeah. So fact two is this one really pissed me off. Trans athletes do not have an unfair advantage in sports. So like this one pissed me off because I was like, we're not talking about trans athletes. So the myth that they attach to this is trans athletes' physiological characteristics provide an unfair advantage over cis athletes. And I just cannot believe how disingenuous they're being, because obviously, really, the only thing that we're talking about is males competing against females. We're not talking, I don't care about the trans. Like, it doesn't really matter how you identify. It's nothing against trans people.
Yeah, they try to make it so, like, why don't you want trans people to play in these sports?
Yeah.
I've used the example sometimes of, like, you know, if you're in line for a roller coaster and you're a trans person and you happen to be, like, 4'8". And you go over there and they say, like, I'm sorry, sir, you're not tall enough to ride this roller coaster. Like, that's not transphobia. Like, you're just too short to ride the roller coaster. Like, and that's the same thing with male and female sports. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, sir, you can't play in this league because you're a male. It's like, that's not transphobia. That's just, you know, that's just the rule that they had in this sport for safety reasons. This is why you can't ride the roller coaster if you're not 5 feet tall or something. It's like the rule isn't based on whether you're trans, because again, trans isn't, it's just an identity. You can not transition in any way and be considered trans. And at least everyone I know would be perfectly fine with a trans man, you know, competing in female sports, so long as they're not taking like testosterone, because, you know, if they're just literally identifying as a man, but they're still physiologically 100% female and not taking steroids, then yeah, they should be able to compete in women's leagues because it's for females. So yeah, that pisses me off so much too. There was a tweet I think I did today where they're doing the same thing. They're like, trans girls, like, they just want to be with their friends. They just want to play and go to school and learn and be with their friends. And it's just, they're just trying to portray us as these monsters. Like, why don't you want them to learn and play and be with their friends?
It's, yeah, like, why won't you let trans people play sports? It's like, that's not my intention at all.
It's like, they're like, everyone, like, no one is saying that trans people shouldn't be able to play sports. Maybe there's some person out there who just hates trans people, who's just like, they shouldn't do anything. That person, because someone's going to say, like, this person's crazy and they don't want trans people to play any sports. But at least all the people I see in this discussion, it's not trying to keep trans people out of sports. It's just saying, like, you need to play in a category that you should be playing in. Or at least, at the very least, the female category needs to have some criteria for excluding people. You know, I've always been an advocate of the women's league, which is based on they can have their own DSD rules. If, you know, if they want Castris Minia to be able to play or not, they can make those rules if they want to, but there needs to be some criteria. Like, you have to draw a line somewhere, otherwise there's no line and then it's not a protected category. And then I think, you know, we shouldn't have a men's league. It should just be an open category where anybody can play if they want to, no matter how they identify. You know, only limiting thing would be if they're taking performance enhancing drugs. But yeah, so like a women's league and an open league, or if you don't want to say women, just say the protected league. I don't know, whatever you, how you would do it, but there needs to be something, some protected category. Book of Wild. What's fact three?
Fact three was including trans athletes will benefit everyone. I mean, except for women, of course. But meh. But it's it's just so rude, and they're just like, you're so rude. Like, don't tell that to me as a statement. Like, it will. Like, oh, okay, since you say so, the ACLU Twitter account. So it says, myth: the participation of trans athletes hurts cis women. And then they're their fact or their, you know, further explanation says, excluding women who are trans hurts all women. It invites gender policing that could subject any woman to invasive tests or accusations of being too masculine or too good at their sport to be a real woman. That's a tricky one, eh?
Well, I mean, excluding someone who, you know, an adult from children's sport, you know, you could be subjecting them to these invasive tests and claims of being too old looking to play against children. Like, you can just make the same argument about why men should be able to play in children's leagues. I mean, it's the exact same argument, but they're loading the argument from the beginning by saying, like, they want to say, like, women's sports, and then, of course, woman to them means this identity category. And then it's just like, well, what's the point in having gendered categories in the first place? Like, that's the one thing they won't address. They want women and men, the identities, to have different categories. And therefore, the males should be able to compete in female sports as long as they have a certain identity. But they don't exist, like, the normative argument of, well, what's the argument for even having, you know, segregated sports based on identity? Like, what's the argument for that? And they just really don't address that whatsoever. They just sweep that under the rug.
Right. So. Yeah, I mean, I guess then it's like, if they're going to make these arguments, then why not just make all sports for everyone and there's no women's or men's leagues? And then, again, we come back to this thing where it's like, well, why is it important for you to compete in the women's league, you know, or compete, you know, compete with and against women? I mean,
yeah, that's why if you have the open league, that,
like,
gets
what
rid of
does
the
category include? What is the category for? I mean, are, like, answer that. Like, why? I mean, of course they won't answer it, but
I mean, this is what another... Rachel McKinnon or Veronica Ivy, is that her name?
I can't remember the name became.
But I mean, she had a was it? She was going up for tenure or something like that, and her department sort of gave her tenure review case. I think that's what it was. But anyway, it was pretty kind of, they kind of blasted her by saying that, like, you know, you constantly talk about all these cases of why, you know, trans women should compete in women's sports, but they didn't see that she was making the case, like the normative argument for why there should be sex or gender segregated sports in the first place. And of course, she just, like, I think she was in the process of suing her university department for transphobia or something. That was her response to that. So
naturally.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. And then fact four is trans people belong on the same teams as other students. And what else do they say? Okay. So then the myth is that trans students need separate teams. So, and then they go on to say, trans people, like all people, may experience detrimental effects to their physical and emotional well-being when they're pushed out of affirming spaces and communities. Efforts to exclude subsets of girls from sports can undermine team unity. And youth derive the most benefits from athletics when they are exposed to caring environments where teammates are supported by each other and by coaches.
I mean, I'm sure that there's a lot of adult men who would feel bad about, you know, not being included in children's sports as well. I mean, what was the language they used, and what was the first couple of sentences of that?
Oh, they said, trans people, like all people, may experience detrimental effects to their physical and emotional well-being when they're pushed out of affirming spaces and communities.
I've seen the videos on, like, the men who identify as children. They exist. I'm sure they would feel anxiety and, you know, socially ostracized if they were told that they couldn't compete on a children's team in line with how they think. Too bad. I don't know. I mean, it's just like, what do you say? Like, sorry. Like, no.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you could just extend that to anything. I mean,
what about the girls on the team who, you know, or the opposing team who don't want to have to compete against a male athlete? I mean, I'm sure there's plenty. I mean, we know that they exist, but the Connecticut, I can't remember their names, the two girls that are, like, suing the school because there were,
I think one's Selena, really Selena Sewell or something like that. I may have looked up that name, so apologies if I
mean, they're the rare example of people actually speaking up on this, but there's plenty who believe the same thing, that they're getting, you know, cheated out of their scholarships for going to school. I mean, there's consequences for having males compete, especially at a high school level. I mean, people are still, this is when the testosterone is driving this, you know, the male advantage for like track and field and pretty much every other category you can do. And these aren't even elite athletes too. So these differences are going to matter more among the general population of that will create, you know, a male more likely to win in a high school sporting situation. So, yeah, I mean, the well-being of the girls on the team who are either losing or getting injured, and I mean, that should be taken into account.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the odd thing about really all of these arguments, like particularly around sports and inclusion and, you know, the well-being of students. And it's like, you're not, I mean, you literally don't care at all how the girls feel. Like, this is like a very tiny minority of people who are identifying as transgender and wanting to play for the opposite sex's team. But like, you know, what about the 99%? Like, what about, you know, how do these girls feel about sharing change rooms or locker rooms with boys or men? How do these girls feel about having, I remember, you know, when I really liked PE when I was a kid, I was like pretty sporty. And it was sex segregated, until grade 11. And then after grade 11, it became co-ed. And then I just stopped taking PE. It's not because, like, I have a problem with boys or the boys were shitty. It's like, well, I don't want to play basketball against boys because then I don't get to play. Like, you know, I don't want to play floor hockey against the guys because then I don't get to play. Like, you just can't because you just
– yeah.
Like, why would anybody pass to you a girl who obviously sucks more than that guy? And it's not because girls suck. It's just, like, you're not as fast. You're not as tall. You're not as strong. And, you know, the reality, like, you feel really self-conscious at that age. So you're, like, feeling self-conscious playing sports with boys, and you're feeling, you know, threatened and dominated and just, you know, self-conscious. And, like, and I don't mean those feelings are exclusive to girls, but, I mean, it's just, you know, I don't understand how they can get away with not considering or asking how the girls feel and how it impacts the girls.
It's amazing. I mean, all those facts that you're listing, the ACLU did. I mean, it's the type of things that I just ask, how are they getting away with these most ridiculous things? I read it and it's just like, how are people's heads not spinning? I mean, some people's are, like, your head's spinning, mine's head spinning.
Yeah.
But how did the feminists who are, you know, claiming on the left to be championing women's rights, how is this even happening?
Yeah.
It's completely mind-boggling. I don't understand.
Like, all the women, you know, all, like, American feminists, for the most part, American feminists who you would have heard of, you know, the ones who've written, you know, published lots of books, who were, like, really big in the abortion fight, continue to be reproductive rights, you know, like the Jessica Valentis, Sadie Doyle, I don't know what this person changed their name to, I'm sorry. But, you know, like, all of the big American feminists, like, are just going along with this. And I'm like, okay. I mean, number one, you clearly have no integrity. I don't respect any of you at all. You guys make more money than I do. You know, like, you have, you know, you're getting paid a lot for your very boring columns, your book deals, so on and so forth. You have huge followings on social media. You have clout. You have power. But how do you look at this and say, yeah, this is feminism?
So you think there are a lot of them are actually, you think some of them are actually just know what they're doing and they're just sold out? Is that?
Oh, yeah. I think that they have no integrity, and I think that they care more about their own social status and career opportunities than they do about telling the truth and doing what's right. Some of them are just dumb, but...
Yeah, but I've had interaction on Twitter with Anne Fausto Sterling, where she made that, you know, the five sexes, the herms, merms, and whatever, all those things. And then she made a claim, it was on Twitter, and I guess she made it elsewhere too, that was actually, oopsie, I was being tongue-in-cheek when I said there were five sexes. And I just read that and I was like, holy shit, you were being tongue-in-cheek? Like, I am getting people sending me, these are PhDs, and they're sending me this article about how there's five sexes and how much of a bigot I am. And now you have the gall to say that you were just being tongue-in-cheek, hee-hee. And then when I called her out on that, her response, I said, like, you need to correct the record because this is your record to correct. And her response to me was just like, I can't remember exactly, but it was just like, I'll correct the record when you do X, Y, and Z. And like, I'm just like, you're admitting that you've lied, or at least it was untrue. And you're admitting to like the potential damage that it causes. But now you're holding the truth a ransom because you thought I was rude to you on Twitter. Like, holy crap.
That's amazing.
The tweet's still up there. And she tweeted at me and was like, how dare you, young man? This is not becoming of you. it's like, wow.
I don't know what to think. You know, and I also don't know what to think about people like Judith Butler, because I'm just like, are you just not very bright? Like, that's honestly what I think. I'm like, if you read Judith Butler's writing, it's doesn't make any sense. She's a terrible writer. She's a terrible thinker. So I think she's just gotten away with writing like gobbledygook for so long that she's like, I'm just going to roll with this. And I just think she's just not a very intelligent person. I mean, probably not much integrity.
Didn't she win one of those like worst paragraphs awards or something like that for like most, most impenetrable I remember reading it and it was just like, holy crap. Like, what is going on here? And yeah, I mean, I think people like that, I mean, the best science educators make you feel like you're just, it's effortless learning because they're just so good at making complex things simple. But you get these people in here who are just trying to make simple things sound super complex because they don't really have anything to offer. They're just, maybe it's just like this inferiority complex about, you know, science envy or something, and they're trying to sound sciencey because the things they're dealing with are actually kind of simple, and so they have to just sort of put this weird like linguistic tinsel on everything that they do
to make. Yeah, finish.
Yeah, no, that's it. I just think they're trying to gussy up their bad ideas with complex thought to make them seem more profound.
Yeah, I think so too. And justify their discipline, justify their prestige or whatever. I mean, it's how you learn to write in academia, at least in the humanities. As I said, I have a lot of experience. I've written many, many essays about gender, and used all the correct words that didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. You feel smart. And you're getting A's and everyone else is using this language. So you sort of believe that it means something. And I think you believe that you sound smart to people who don't know better. So they're just not going to question you. They're going to be like, oh God, post-colonial, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. Like, and when I was doing my BA and master's degree, I don't know that I was doing it intentionally. I was probably like too young or naive to realize that was what was happening. But, you know, I knew that I could just regurgitate these essays really, really easily and get A's on everything. And so people who continue in this discipline in academia, I think, have to sort of perpetuate that to justify, like I said, their status, their job, essentially, their discipline. Yeah. You're right. It might have something to do with like science envy, although I'm sure they would never admit to that. But they're like, this is just as important and real and legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is that the complex language too is what kind of gets people that deer in the headlights moment when all of a sudden they get attacked for something that they don't know what they said. Didn't like the Mumford and Son guy, didn't he just get piled on recently?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not on Twitter, so I miss all this stuff. And I feel
like someone, I might be getting the guy wrong, but it was some well-known musician. He told people that he liked Andy Ngo's book on Antifa. He just gave it like a positive review or something.
This sounds familiar.
And people were just like, this was like last week or something like that. And everyone piled on him about, you know, I'm sure I didn't see the tweets that were, but I'm sure it was just a lot of this jargon that's coming at him. And his gut response is like, everyone's mad. They're using words I've never seen before. They sound really intelligent, maybe. And it's just, I'm just going to put out an apology because what the hell am I going to do? Like, there's a steep learning curve. Well, I don't even know. It's almost like unlearning, but there's a steep curve to just familiarizing yourself with the jargon to the point where you can understand that it's actually kind of bullshit. And this is what people like, you know, James Lindsay and Pelham Pluckrose have done, is they're sort of like the Rosetta Stone for a lot of people out there for this jargon. And they really just show that, like, actually this means this really simple concept that's really stupid. And here's what they're saying.
Well, and you could just say it like that. I mean, I'm an editor, you're an editor, so you probably edit a lot of people's writing.
Yeah.
But you'll find that with academics, you're like, you could just say this in 5 words, and instead you've said it in 20, and you've said it in using words that are not words that ordinary people understand. And you're writing, you're not, the point of writing to me is not to try to impress your reader with how many big words you know, or how, like, you know, fancy, like, your sentence can be, or convoluted or complex. It's to make your point as clearly and as succinctly as possible so that people understand what you're talking about, and so that something's easy to read, so that you don't have to think about, like, I don't want to have to reread your sentence 4 times to figure out what you're talking about. I want to understand what you're trying to convey.
Yeah. This is what I see of those diagrams, like the sex spectrum diagram and the, you know, Scientific American. That's just like all these boxes and the arrows going everywhere and just crisscrossing and this different colors. And it's just like, they're just trying to make things seem like super complex so that people just seem like, you know, they get that deer in the headlights stunned moment. And they're just like, well, where do I even begin to pull this thread? Luckily, someone I know, Emma Hilton, someone you should also get on here to talk to. She is basically spending time deconstructing this whole thing and showing how, like, they're just purposely moving these boxes and areas to, like, force arrows across the entire diagram where they don't even need to, just to, like, make it look more complex. And, you know, they even have an individual who has, like, male gonads and a penis over there. They're, like, further on the female side of the spectrum than, like, somebody who's clearly identifiably female. And it just makes no sense. They're just putting out so much crap out there to try to confuse people. And you know, it's a lot easier to tie knots in the truth than it is to, like, spend time and be like, oh god, I gotta untie this thing and set the record straight. So
I'm curious to know how you think this all ends. Does it end, like, do you see, you know, this turning around, or is it kind of too late? You know, where do you predict this is all headed?
I think it will improve. I think the resistance has been building up for the last 2 years, and then I feel like in the last year it's been getting people are starting to wake up to how insane it is. Unfortunately, the activists on the other side, who are, you know, muddling reality as much as they can, they have like a pretty big head start. So I think things are going to get way more insane before they get better, especially with, you know, if we have things like the Equality Act that Biden is putting through, that's going to be including gender identity within the definition of sex and applies to all federally funded organizations. And, oh, now self-identity is all that matters. So yeah, I think we're in for a lot more insanity, but in a way, that could be a good thing, because there's like this accelerationist approach that I'm becoming more and more sort of keen to, where it's just like, the faster the absurdity is brought out in full, the quicker that the opposition is going to just do a triple take and be like, wait, what the hell is going on here? Like, this, as soon as we have just males identifying into women's sports, just like, okay, here's taking all the medals. Here's the Olympics. Half the team is male on the women's team.
Yeah.
I mean, it can't last. And most people think it's completely ridiculous. Most small children know the differences between males and females. You have to just like go through some super complex anti-education to even like arrive at some of the ideas that people are spouting today. So I think common sense will rule the day, but it's going to take a lot of effort, because a lot of the laws that are being put in, no one's voting on these laws. They're just sort of rechanging the definition of what it means to be a woman. And they're saying, oh, well, woman now refers to a gender identity. And so everything that was put in the context of sex-based rights is now completely unenforceable, and is now enforceable in this entirely other parallel, not even parallel, orthogonal issue that has nothing to do with the original intent of any of these laws. And people are going to just wake up to that fact. I mean, they are in every single day. And it's not even just that. I mean, this is this whole, I guess the many branches of this ideology is sort of, you have on the issues of sexism, you have the queer theory type stuff going that's blurring all the boundaries and the gender ideology. And then you have also when applying to race issues, you have the critical race theory stuff that's all based on sort of that critical theory. Then you have like the post-colonialism. These are all just like these manifestations of a sort of a very similar starting point. That's just looking at power dynamics and social construction and all that stuff. And I think they're all going to get worse before they get better, but I do think they're going to get better. Could be a decade or more, but I think we're moving in the right direction, or at least the opposing force is starting to push back the other way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people are getting more bold, but yeah, the legislation aspect and the policy aspect is going to complicate things for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. I'm so glad we finally got a chance to talk. Yeah, awesome. I really enjoyed it.
I need to have you on my podcast once it launches fairly soon.
Oh, okay. Tell me about your podcast. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. So I've been meaning to launch it for a long time. It's called Reality's Last Stand. It's named after my Substack, which was itself named after a tweet that was really popular. And it's the podcast. It's just going to be another guy with a podcast who interviews people about sort of these issues. Probably a lot of sex and gender, some evolution, wide variety of guests. I already interviewed Jody Shaw for the first episode. She's the Smith College woman who was sort of battling the critical race theory stuff. She's awesome. I love her so much. But I'll be starting to get sort of a guest list lined up here in the next week or so. So stay tuned for that.
All righty. Good stuff. Thank you so much. We'll be in touch off social media. Take care. So bye-bye. Yep. I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this interview, please consider becoming a patron on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Megan Murphy. I rely solely on donors and individual supporters to continue to do the work I do. You can donate as little as $5 a month or more. It all counts. Thank you so much for supporting conversations outside the algorithm.